Welcome to One True Podcast. My name is Mark Chirino, and my producer is Michael Von Cannon. In his memoir, A Movable Feast, Ernest Hemingway wrote, "All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know." So finally, I would write one true sentence and then go on from there. In that same spirit of honesty, creativity, and curiosity, One True Podcast explores all things related to Ernest Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Today's show continues our specialty episodes where we take Hemingway at his own premise. We ask our guests a very simple question, their choice for Hemingway's one true sentence, and then as Hemingway writes, we go on from there. This series of shows will be collected into a book called One True Sentence, Writers and Readers on Hemingway's Art, to be published by Godin in July 2022 and already available for pre-order. Today, we welcome Michael Katakis to our program. Michael Katakis is a writer and photographer who has traveled extensively and has published prolifically. To name just a few, his nonfiction book, A Thousand Shards of Glass, There Is Another America, and Ernest Hemingway, Artifacts from a Life, which has been widely translated, and also a recent foray into fiction, the book of short stories, Dangerous Men. He also served as an important voice in the recent Hemingway documentary directed by former guests Ken Burns and Lynn Novick. So we are delighted to talk to him today about Hemingway and writing. Michael Katakis, welcome to One True Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Michael, what is your one true sentence and why?
My one true sentence, my favorite of his, is from Indian Camp, and it's the last sentence. In the early morning on the lake, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he felt quite sure that he would never die. Haven't we all felt that way in youth? We have felt exactly what that young man felt. You know you will, but no, you don't. It seems so far away, perhaps something that you will never get to, even though you know you will. And for a while, that feeling is intoxicating.
That feeling of immortality.
Yes, indeed.
And to complicate that, it is a grown man looking back at a childhood memory and incorporating a relationship with his father in all of this. And I'm thinking about how Hemingway captures youth and fathers and sons in this narrative.
Yes. I think when we dig a little deep, you know, we don't have to go so deep, quite frankly. Look at this story. The young man's father is a doctor, like Ernest's father. They loved fishing and being out in the wild. This young man is there. That this is so autobiographical. And Hemingway, if this event most probably did not happen, he can imagine it, and he can imagine him with his father and as a young lad asking this question and then coming to that conclusion. I think Hemingway throughout his life is drawing upon everything that he's experiencing and seeing and hearing. For instance, The Short Happy Life of Francis Macomber comes from something he heard while on safari, some story that had taken place that was real.
So he transmutes it into fiction, into a dramatic scene.
Yes.
To capture that mood.
Yes, and I think his comments about his advice about starting with one true sentence, which, by the way, works, and I use it, but where I found that it was equally helpful and useful was applying it to the last line as well. so that you start with one true sentence, but you also end with it. And so, if it isn't true, to make it seem true.
When you write fiction, Michael, do you know what the last sentence is going to be when you start writing?
It's usually the first thing that's written. I don't know why, but I seem to be good at seeing the endings of things. It's the rest of it I find confounding, you know, to
getting to the end.
But the endings are so much like a photograph. They are a snapshot of just a moment. And now you're trying to turn that snapshot into a full-length film.
Michael, when we talk to our guests about their one true sentences, it seems like a majority of them turn to these early stories. As you think about Hemingway, his career in writing and his prose, are you also drawn to the In Our Time stories or the early stories as having some particular quality that, though great, perhaps later in his career was not quite the same?
That's a very good question. I can only answer it from my point of view. I agree with Edna O'Brien that a certain amount of these short stories are miracles. You look at them on the page and you just don't quite understand how they happened by a human hand. They just seem to have always been there. The short stories for me are jewels. And no matter what happened, I think they were so extraordinary and are so extraordinary that Hemingway going forward had to measure up to the stories he had written in the beginning. Sometimes he got close, other times he did not. But when I go back to the short stories, I'm struck by how amazing they are, and especially from a young man.
A story like Indian Camp that you isolated for today's conversation is also striking because as you read that last sentence, it sounds so beautiful and ideal, and you kind of forget that earlier in the story, there was unbelievable violence and trauma for this young boy. And I think one of the miracles that you're talking about is that those two extreme emotions can coexist in just a few pages of this story.
Yes.
I wonder if you're, how you tackle that as a reader or a writer, that kind of volatility in Hemingway's work.
Well, I have, the one thing that I have taken from Professor Hemingway is that to imply something, to imply it, to show it to a certain extent, but to imply is so much more powerful than explaining it all. Yes, we understand about the young man not being able to stand the screams of his wife, but he doesn't go into great detail of how the young man commits suicide. The mere fact that he does is so shocking, so horrific, and yet you can understand if you identify with someone you love going through such horror, what it must be like. And so what I find so fascinating about him and so extraordinary is the implying of terrible, terrible things wrapped in such beautiful, beautiful language. And that's almost like a Sebastio Salgado photograph of the workers of some horrible conditions for human beings. But the photographs are so stunningly beautiful that you almost feel guilty admiring them.
I was just going to ask how the iceberg theory or this principle of suggestion or implication, I can see how you would view Professor Hemingway when you do your writing, but there's a photography equivalent to implication and suggestion and not telling the whole story. Is that true?
Absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head. One of the terrible things that has happened with digital photography is not the digital photography itself. It's the ability that one has now to pretend they are editor and photographer at the same time. In other words, there's no pause. So you take many photographs when you should have taken one and then watched the world. So when I'm asked to help young photographers, this is my advice, and I think it applies to the writing. You take your digital camera out into the street. You put in your mind how many rolls of film you have in your pocket. Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? Let's say it's one. You have 36 frames. That's all you get for the day. And you take the photographs and you never look at the screen until you are finished for the day and go back, so that you are surprised by what you might have seen. I think this applies to the writing. Don't keep looking back and forth, back and forth. Let the characters speak to you. Let the reader be surprised.
That's so fascinating. As you're saying that, the last page of Indian Camp, at least in my edition, is an exchange between Nick and his father that's all in dialogue, and there's no speech tags. Right. So Hemingway's allowing the trusting the reader to hear the dialogue, the relationship developing between the father and son. And you're saying photography works in a very similar way, the relationship between the viewer of the photograph and the taker of the photograph.
Well, life is composing itself around you all the time. That is a fact of living. The question for me has always been, are you quiet enough and engaged enough to see it? And I think what was happening with Hemingway, he was seeing things as a young man and experiencing them, and he was observing things, as I said in the film, like a hawk. He was looking at everything. Nothing escaped his eyes or his senses, the taste of food or drink, the way the woman walked, whatever. And he pared that down to the essential. And he trusted that the reader was going along with him, that he didn't have to explain.
Back after this. This episode of One True Podcast is supported by the Hemingway Review, the scholarly journal of the Ernest Hemingway Foundation and Society. Michael and I are huge fans of the Hemingway Review. We always read it to see the latest scholarship. You can buy back issues of the Hemingway Review at hemingwaysociety.org/journals. Independent and employee-owned publisher W.W. Norton is proud to announce new Norton critical editions of In Our Time, edited by J. Gerald Kennedy, and The Sun Also Rises, edited by Michael Thurston. Both volumes include a rich selection of contextual and critical materials, carefully curated to enhance the reader's understanding of and appreciation for Hemingway's prose and life. Read by millions, Norton critical editions have set the standard for teaching and appreciating classic works since 1961. Learn more at www.norton.com/Hemingway. So in that context, one true sentence really means what? What does true mean in that sense? Authentic?
Yes.
Actual, what is this? Is there a synonym, or are there several synonyms to what he was getting at? Because true seems, it seems so broad that it may not have meaning.
I think all of the above, quite frankly. I think, does one true sentence mean one true sentence? Yes. And I think it then goes beyond that. It goes way beyond that. Because what is the perception of the truth he's looking at? We can read that last sentence as he wrote it, or we could start to ask questions, couldn't we? What do you mean he thought he wasn't going to die? How ridiculous all this.
Right.
There's a nuance in here that if someone stops and thinks for a moment and remembers their youth, they will understand it completely. Hemingway is trusting the reader to connect with what is a universal theme of being a human being. Yeah. He doesn't feel the need, you know, this is what this meant. So it is not just one true sentence. It's a sentence of perception, of shared perception.
And it is trusting because, Michael, you could read that last sentence and say, what a silly kid.
Right.
What a silly kid to have such a fantastical thought. That's couldn't be farther from the truth.
Right.
And Hemingway is not guiding us away from that, right? He's leaving it wide open.
And he does it without sentimentality. And boy, that is quite a feat. Here is a young man. Here's his life. He's sure he won't die. That could get very juicy, you know, very sentimental, but not here. And not here.
Good point. This discussion makes me think of the first couple pages of Death in the Afternoon, where Hemingway is saying, as a young writer, I tried to figure out essentially what the detail that produced the emotion was, what made it linger in his memory, and then how then to convey it to the reader. And it seems also, not only is that something that is obviously applicable when you would sit down to write, but also in photography.
Oh, yes.
That the details you capture would also be something that you go for. So maybe not one true sentence, but one true detail.
Yes.
Do you have thoughts about that in terms of any medium that you would apply it to?
There's an irony about, I will just tell you about photography. There's an irony. My photographs, before they reached the institutions they ended up in, I was very concerned all the time, very deliberative, paying very much attention, too much attention. It is when I started to absolutely not care about the taking of a picture anymore, was the aperture in the right place, that the pictures became alive. And I didn't know it at the time, but I made a conscious decision somehow, or an unconscious decision, to make a choice. And the choice was to look at life and snap. And there might be imperfection in the photograph, but I would capture the essence of it. Hemingway is far more precise, and he does so by making it look as if he's taking a photograph like I am. Initially, he is working with deep precision, but making it look like it's serendipity.
Yeah.
And that is the magic. And perhaps that is what's so elusive. Maybe that is at the heart of it, what talent is.
Couldn't this also be, you've put in the time and the training, the learning for decades, then at some point you just have to trust your instinct and let the artistry of it take over. And of course, you've chose a story that is young Hemingway, young Hemingway. So we're finding him at the very beginning of figuring out this technique.
Yes. I came across a letter, I believe it was a letter a number of years ago, where he had written to someone or made mention to someone, and I've gone to the orangery to look at the paintings, the Cezannes that he looked at, and as Ken Burns and Lynn Novak did so well, bringing out the idea of Bach and the repetitiveness, but he also says in that exchange with someone, I want to paint the way Cezanne paints the country. I want to write the way he paints the countryside. And he was trying to figure out why those empty spaces, why they worked. Then he realized they weren't empty spaces. They framed everything. And I think there was a lot of, you know, this artistic life, you know, it's an endless, just as scholars keep up digging more and more information we didn't know, I think the artistic life is this constant surprise at what has eluded you. And it seems so simple when you find it.
With that simplicity in mind, Michael, would you please read your choice for Hemingway's One True Sentence one more time?
Yes, of course. Honored to do so, actually, this great work. In the early morning on the lake, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he felt quite sure that he would never die.
Michael Katakis, thank you so much for joining us on One True Podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to you all for listening in. This episode is available on onetruepod.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Our show is supported by the Hemingway Society, the English Department at the University of Evansville, and Florida Gulf Coast University. Join us next time as we continue exploring Hemingway, his life, his work, and his world. Until then, I'm Mark Chirino with Michael Von Cannon, and this is One True Podcast. Oh,